Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm the site's managing editor, Matt Goldberg, and with me today is associate editor Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
So normally we talk about the big, wide-release films, but this weekend was The Other Woman, The Quiet Ones, and I think there was another, Brick Mansions, which was a tawdry attempt to cash in on Paul Walker's death with what probably should have been a straight-to-DVD film. And so we're not going to talk about those. The only one I saw was The Other Woman, which was basically made by Leslie Mann, but there were a lot of people who didn't really like it at all. But that's okay. And Adam, you didn't see The Other Woman, I assume?
No, did not have a screening of it.
And I don't want to make you pay money for it, because it's not that kind of movie.
My girlfriend wants to see it. She was like, I could get someone to see it with me. I was like, oh, I think that's for the best.
Probably for the best.
I'm totally watching it. It's not one of those that I'm like adversely like, I'm not seeing a romantic comedy.
No, no. But like, it's taking the time and paying the... This is... I would say The Other Woman, briefly, is a film to watch on HBO or if you're on an airplane.
Sure, yeah.
Though it's that kind of movie. Especially an airplane movie. I would say that. Anyway, this week we're going to talk about indie films because the summer movie season is about to begin. I don't care how much they try to push it back to April. I know that Captain America's come out. For me personally, the summer movie season doesn't begin until the first week of May. That is when it begins for real. And it'll begin with The Amazing Spider-Man 2, which we'll talk about next week. But before that all happens, we thought we would talk about indie films that are coming your way. And we went to Sundance earlier this year, and a lot of Sundance films usually come out in the summer, and that's their way of still getting attention, still getting people to see them, and dodging the second wave of festival films, which is the big festival circuit, the TIFF, the New York Film Festival, the Telluride, that just every fall film festival coming at you. And so the Sundance films, some will still come out in that time, but a lot of them sort of just come out a little bit ahead and function as counter-programming. And they also live in this new world of indie distribution, which is VOD. And that's exciting as well, because people who wouldn't have access to an art house theater now have the chance to watch these films in the comfort of their own home. And while obvious, I'm not like, fuck the art house, I'm glad that people at least have these chances to see these films. For instance, you can rent Joe on demand, and I highly recommend that you do. So that came out last week or a couple weeks ago. But right now,
it's
looking
not out
ahead,
here yet.
I'm not out here.
I'm very much looking forward to it.
It's not on VOD?
I'm sure it is. I'm not a huge fan of VOD. I really like going to the theater to watch movies. So
I'm not
averse to it, but, you know, I mean, I know it's cheaper. Like, if my girlfriend and I are going to watch a movie, it's cheaper to get it for $5.99, but I like the experience of going out to the theater.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it's not. It's actually, sometimes it's just as much. Like, if you were to rent, I remember Drinking Buddies, I wanted to rent that to watch it on a plane. It was $10. I'm like, no.
No.
I'll watch it when it comes to Netflix. And I did. And I liked it. But no, $10 is a movie ticket price, and I understand that. But and I don't want to steer people away from VOD, because a lot of these films we'll be recommending will be on VOD. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is, personally, I also prefer a movie theater, but also, I would prefer for people to see these films however they can. So that's just my opinion. If you know it's going to come to an art house near you, because that's also the question. Sometimes you don't know if the film will be opening near you. That's also part of the question. So it's sort of like, do I wait? Do I sit on it? What do I do? In the hopes that it'll be opening in a theater near me. But whether these films are opening near you or not, we just want to put them on your radar. And so right now, we're going to start off with the merry month of May in terms of these indie releases. I have opened my browser to each upcoming month. So in May, what I wanted to kick off with is in terms of May 9th, because May 2nd is basically owned by Amazing Spider-Man 2. I haven't seen Belle. I know that screened at a few festivals, but moving on to May 9th, we have The Double and God's Pocket. We both saw God's Pocket. Also, Chef. I have not seen Chef, though. Chef is sort of like in the middle, though. It's not going to be on VOD, but it's not going to be a wide release either.
Yeah, I feel like it'll expand to most territories.
It will, but it's not VOD. Whereas, like, The Double is VOD and God's Pocket. It's IFC Films, so I think they usually do they don't have VOD. Or maybe they're selective with it, because, like, IFC is Boyhood, and Boyhood is straight-up theatrical release from the get-go. It's not going to be on VOD from the beginning. At least that's my understanding of it. And, like, they didn't do VOD for Blue is the Warmest Color when that came out. So, God's Pocket, we'll talk about that one, because we both saw it. That's one you may want to avoid if it comes near. It's
that,
not...
That was disappointing, too.
Disappointing.
It's John Slattery's directorial debut, who... is Roger Sterling for Mad Men. He's directed a handful of episodes of Mad Men, so it's not like he doesn't have experience, and it's also one of Philip Seymour Hoffman's last roles, and it's a leading role, but it's just not good. It's tonally very weird. It's not very consistent. It's not exactly funny, but it's not exactly dramatic. It doesn't really resonate.
It has these weird moments of, like, dark humor. But for the most part, it's just like a gross, sad movie.
It is. It doesn't it doesn't make you feel good watching it. It's not that it makes you feel bad, but you just feel kind of gross. Just living in this tiny city for the hour and a half the movie runs. It's just not an enjoyable experience. And it's not that terrible things happen. It's not like I didn't enjoy watching 12 Years a Slave, but I, you know, can
but you got something rewarding out of it, like in terms of you were in, it's not the way characters behave is gross, but it's not a gross world where, like, you feel dirty in that sense. Like, you feel the real tragedy, like there's a real emotional core, whereas, like, God's Pocket is like falling down in mud. it really like you just feel like in sticky filth, and it's just like and it's just like you don't get anything from that experience. You just feel gross. Like, there's nothing deeper there. It's just a shitty feeling. In God's Pocket. That's one. But I will say this, though. Hoffman's the performances are good. It's good performances. And I was talking with Chris Bumbray from Joe Blow afterwards about the film at Sundance. And he was like, this is a film that felt, I agree with his assessment, that felt very much given over to its actors. Like, it's an actor's film, where it's like, I'm just going to let it free flow, and whatever ideas the actors want to contribute is fine, which makes it a film for great performances, but as far as good storytelling, there's no one at the wheel.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
A film you should definitely go see, that I can't wait to see again, is Richard Ayoade's The Double. Ayoade previously directed Submarine, and he's also an actor. He starred in The Watch, which was not a good film, although he was very good in it, and on The IT Crowd, which is a really funny series that I believe is on Netflix. It also stars Chris O'Dowd, and he's great on that. And those comic sensibilities do pop up in The Double, but The Double is, the best way I can describe it, is a comedic thriller. Like, there is a very intense plot to it, which is that Jesse Eisenberg plays two roles. One is Simon James, who is a meek office drone who has been working in the same office for 7 years and no one even realizes that he's been there. They think he's just started. That's how unknown he is. He has a crush on a girl played by Mia Wasikowska, who refers to him as the creepy guy, but in sort of an affectionate way. And he's just very shy and reserved. It's kind of like his Zombieland character. And the environment is almost this reminiscent of Terry Gilliam's Brazil. Like, it's not a world like ours. It's sort of this sort of twisted one. It takes place mostly in shadow. You're not exactly sure what these people do. It's very weird, but captivating. And so Simon James is living out his kind of crappy existence. And then one day someone comes along named James Simon, and it's someone who looks exactly like Simon James. They dress the same, except James Simon has the complete opposite personality. He's confident, he's assertive, and this is the Jesse Eisenberg of The Social Network. And you're basically seeing his two personas play off of each other in a really funny, fascinating way. But it's also just a really smart, interesting film that was just a joy to watch. It's marvelous watching Ayoade balance these two tones in a distinct world. It's got all these great supporting performances around it, like from Wallace Shawn, and Kathleen Turner pops up randomly. Most of his submarine cast is there. There is an amazing recurring cameo appearance from Patty Considine. I won't spoil how he pops up, but when he does, you'll be like, I must have more of this. The way he shows up, you want more of it, and I won't say any more than that. But this is a great film. This will be on VOD, and it will be in theater, so look out for the double. Moving on to May 16th, you have The Immigrant, which I did not think was very good. But I'm starting to realize I'm not much of a James Gray fan. Adam, have you seen any of his films?
I haven't. And for the same reason probably as you, is that none of them have looked very much like up my alley. And yeah, I know that a lot of people love him, so I should give it a shot. I really wanted to see We Own the Night, which is apparently his bad one. But I remember when that one came out, it was really...
It's not good. He created a conflict-free police drama. That was my understanding. It does. I was actually a little impressed. He wrote Blood Ties, which you've seen.
Yes, which was awful.
And it was terrible. Yeah. Two Lovers
but
is
that
okay.
But Blood Ties was a directorial failure as well, so...
And no, yeah, it wasn't just on him. It wasn't like, oh, if only for the script. He also directed Two Lovers, which was... It was okay. Two Lovers isn't bad. I haven't seen The Yards. I really don't want to. Because The Immigrant is just... It's beautiful cinematography. The plot of it is that Marion Cotillard takes place in the early 20th century or late 19th century, where she plays an immigrant and comes to America with her sister. And her sister is sick, so they deport her sister. And so Marion Cotillard is like, how will I get my sister? And so Joaquin Phoenix plays basically a pimp, but under the guise of a guy who simply runs a burlesque show, but really he's a pimp. And so she sort of falls under his influence reluctantly, but then she starts falling for his brother, who's played by Jeremy Renner, and that's sort of an interesting relationship. But it's kind of just a moribund film with very little dramatic pull. Joaquin Phoenix is very good. The thing I like about his performance is that they let you judge his character does despicable things and feels regret for them, and they don't tell you how to feel about his character. But a large portion of the film is just Marion Cotillard going, my sister! I have to help my sister! It's just, it's not good. it's technically well made in terms of visuals and score, but it's a pretty weak film. So, moving on. Things get good again. And Adam, I swear to God, I will let you talk. We are going to get to...
We're getting through, like, right now, May is the Sundance movies you saw, and then, like, July is the Sundance movies I saw. So,
and I'll shut my goddamn whore mouth. But May 23rd, you have a really good one from IFC called Cold in July, which is this weird crime thriller that keeps taking these jarring turns where you have no idea where it's going to go. It starts off with Michael C. Hall playing a guy who kills a home intruder. And this sets off a huge chain of events where it just goes kind of bonkers, especially when Don Johnson's character enters the picture. And it's a film where, like, you don't want to spoil anything for anyone, so I'm not going to go in depth other than to say this is a film that's going to constantly keep you guessing and really throw you some jarring tonal shifts, but in a good way. Not where it's like you're going to be punched out of the film for a while and then it's going to draw you back in. So at least that was the experience for me. So Cold in July, definitely keep that one on. Tracks also opens in limited release on May 23rd. I did not like that film. A lot of people did. Mia Wasikowska plays... it's based on a true story of a woman who decided to trek across one point of Australia all the way to the Indian Ocean. I forget which part she started from, but it was a long walk, is what you needed to know. And it's just... She's such an aloof character that even though Wojciechowski was a good actress, like, I just didn't care about her walking across. Like, it's just not a rewarding journey as a viewer. A large part of the film is her just learning how to train camels, and boy, was that fascinating. It's just not a film that really hooked me. Some people found it very emotional, like people I talked to when I saw it at TIFF. But for me, I just found it kind of plodding and trying to give the illusion of depth based on the, A, the fact that it's based on a true story, and B, the length of the journey. But just because it was a long journey, I didn't find it a particularly enriching one, or a fulfilling one, rather. So there's that.
I will see that for the sole reason that Adam Driver's in it, because I will now see...
And he's good in it!
I will see anything that he has a significant role in.
He does. He does.
I have learned that he is fantastic in everything, and so I will see.
And that holds true for Tracks. I will say that. It's not one of those films where it's like, man, even it drained. No, he is good in Tracks. So
I'm sure he will be in Star Wars. That's Adam, my reason to see Star Wars now. Adam Driver.
Adam, nothing has been confirmed. We don't know that for a fact yet. Please don't jump to conclusions about Star Wars. Keep the mystery box intact, for God's sake. Fucking Jay. That's, you know what?
Wait, like 5 days. We'll probably be covering this next week, and when the
on May 4th. I know, that's the thing. We're going to want to talk about Spider-Man, and instead we're just going to be talking about, and his person was casted. And that's going to be so... we're just going to take
about it now.
Let's not talk about it now. Let's not talk about it now. Let's get back to moving on to May 30th. I'll have my full review up on the site for Filth before the film comes out, but for our lucky listeners, I'll say Filth is awful. Don't get it on... I mean, you can get it on demand right now, but I thought it was quite poor, to quote Nathan Rabin. If you follow Nathan Rabin on Letterboxd and you see him give a bad review to something, it's usually something he'll cover more in depth on the Dissolve, but if you look at his review, it's just, this film was quite poor. That's all he'll say. And I've started picking that up. Moving on to June 6th, I have not seen Obvious Child. I want to. I've heard good things. Also, Trust Me, which is Clark Gregg's film, and I like Choke. I haven't watched the trailer for Trust Me, but Adam, you did. You said it was a good trailer?
Yeah, I mean, it's all right. It's very obvious. Like, I remember covering this movie before there were any marketing materials. The poster is awful. It looks like a straight-to-DVD, like, family dramedy about a guy who's an agent to kids. But the trailer showed, and I don't know, basically the story is Clark Gregg plays an agent to child stars. He's, you know, down on his luck, finds a girl that could be great, and then his rival, played by Sam Rockwell, is going to, like, snatch her up. But it's told, I mean, the cast is phenomenal, which happens when you're Clark Gregg and everyone loves you and everyone wants to be in your movie. But it looks pretty funny and it looks pretty sweet. It's not near as dark as Choke. Allison Janney's in it, which I got a kick out of because they were both on the West Wing together. And yeah, it looks all right. I can't really judge it based on the trailer because Starz Media is putting it out. And judging by their poster, they're very obviously targeting a certain kind of audience. And I'm not sure that that's the movie that Clark Gregg made. But I'm definitely interested in it.
Yeah. Now I'll definitely be trying to track down that one. Moving on to June 13th, I'm really looking forward to The Rover, but I haven't seen it yet. But if you haven't seen, I'm going to butcher his last name, but David Michaud?
Michaud, I think.
Michaud.
I'm not sure.
M-I-C-H-O-D. It's difficult to pronounce because there's a accent of some kind over the O. It's a symbol that I don't even recognize. It's not an umlaut. It's not an accent. I don't know what it is. It's not a tilde. But whatever it is, it makes his last name. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but you should see his previous film, Animal Kingdom, which is very good. And so this is his follow-up. It stars Robert Pattinson and Guy Pearce. So I'm looking forward to that.
Definitely.
Moving on.
Also, The Signal comes out this weekend, which I knew nothing about, but I watched the trailer and it looked actually really interesting. It's a sci-fi thriller, and it looks quite strange and odd.
I will definitely have to keep an eye out for that.
Yeah.
Now we are going to get you to talk about a film, because on June 20th, Third Person. Why don't you tell the good people about Third Person?
Third Person is from writer-director Paul Haggis, who won an Oscar for Million Dollar Baby, directed Crash, won an Oscar for Crash. And Third Person is I'm not exaggerating, one of the absolute worst movies I've ever seen in my entire life. It's this, you know, hodgepodge, Rashomon-style story of all these different people. Liam Neeson plays a writer that's not so subtly, you know, supposed to be Paul Haggis. And not since M. Night Shyamalan have we seen more hubris on display in third person by the direct writer-director. It's just awful. And it has these twists that start coming in at the end that are so terrible and just ridiculous. And it was, I saw this at Sundance and I was very angry about it.
I thought you saw it at TIFF.
Oh, it was TIFF, yeah. I saw it at TIFF. And I was very angry coming out of the screening. just giant, huge waste of time. I don't know how he put together this terrible cast.
It's that Crash influence, man.
Yeah.
It's just
he just waved that
Oscar around.
Well, you can very much feel that he's trying to reclaim the Crash glory, because he's like, maybe I'll do a movie like Crash again and everyone will love me again. But it's so bad, and Adrian Brody's in it, and he's terrible in it. And I was reminded in the Grand Budapest Hotel that Adrian Brody can actually be good in a movie. But, oh, God.
It's so weird when you say, like, they'll love me again. I kind of like The Next 3 Days. I like that. I think that's a solid...
I never saw The Next 3 Days.
I think it's worth... That's my recommendation. No, it's not. But I would say give The Next 3 Days a chance.
All right.
Because it's not that Paul Hag... I mean, Crash is fucking abysmal. You know what? I will say this. Crash got worse because of its awards love. I only saw it once. I'm not going to revisit it. It's a bad film. And I'm certainly not going to check out Third Person now, because not only you said this, you and Chris Bumbray came. I remember this. I was sitting in the press office or the press lounge at TIFF, and I'm working, and I see you two guys come in, and you're like, we just saw Third Person. And it was one of the worst films we've ever seen.
It's so bad. And it's got, a solid cast, like Olivia Wilde's in it, but it's just, oh, man. Stay away from Third Person. It's also like 3 hours long. I'm sure it got cut.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I didn't know it was that fucking long.
I actually think it was like 220.
But it felt like time stopped.
Yeah.
Yeah. June 27th, I am very, very, very much looking to Snowpiercer, forward to Snowpiercer. This is the cut that Bong Joon-ho wanted. The trade-off was it wasn't going to get a theatrical release. My understanding of how Radius TWC works is that it goes VOD first, and then they can do a limited theatrical rollout.
Yeah, it's the Weinstein Company's VOD arm, so it's
right.
they do a slight theatrical, but it's mostly VOD.
Unless it really catches on, like 20 Feet from Stardom started out on VOD, and then
Lo
and behold, it was really popular with audiences, so they kept it in theaters. Mm-hmm. They pushed it in theaters.
Yeah. And that movie, I feel like I had forgotten about Snowpiercer because we've been talking about that for like a year already. I feel like it already came out.
Yeah, and well, now that people saw it at the Berlin Film Festival.
Yeah.
Let me rephrase. People had seen it because it was released in South Korea. Domestic audiences, most of whom hadn't seen it. We didn't know the cut we would even get.
Yeah.
So that's why I was in limbo. And the film was a hit in South Korea. So that's what I meant when people hadn't seen it. Domestic. He doesn't think South Koreans are people. Get him. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that U.S. audiences are going to get the film that Bong Joon-ho intended, and I'm very happy about that. Moving on to July 2nd, Begin Again. And we had a difference of opinion on this when we saw it at TIFF. When we saw it, it was called Can a Song Save Your Life? Now it has been distilled to Begin Again, which is...
title. It's a terrible title.
That's a title that could be applied to so many other movies.
Yeah.
Like, can a song save your life? I mean, and it's not even like a song. It's a title that
it's catchy.
Is so,
it's different. It, like, you're like, oh, what the hell is that?
Right. Begin Again could apply to so many other things, and it's not like a Once is a title. It's like, well, what does that mean? Like, it's a simple title, but it's an intriguing. And I bring up Once because that John Carney, this is his follow up from Once, is Begin Again. And the premise is that Mark Ruffalo plays a down on his luck record producer, and he's trying to find a good sound. He thinks they all sound like shit, and he goes to a coffee house one night and sees a solo artist played by Keira Knightley and sees her potential and tries to sign her, and she's dealing with her own stuff because she was sort of a... She was the girlfriend of a guy, of a character played by Adam Levine, who started out as... Who basically is the... you see him in the process of selling out, which is pretty entertaining. I mean, there's dramatic heft to it as well, but it's... I think having Adam Levine play it gives it a little extra something, which is a little comic boost, but still retaining the dramatic value. And so you sort of see her trajectory and her striking out on her own. She had sort of been overshadowed by his career. And so she sort of finds her own voice, and this encourages Mark Ruffalo to sort of find his own path. And it's basically about revitalization, or, if you will, beginning again. I thought the film was fine. I was surprised that the Weinstein Company spent so much money to pick it up. This was a big acquisition for them. But a lot of people seem to really like it a lot. For me, this felt like a soft serve once.
That's kind of how I felt, though. I mean, okay. I thought it was okay. When we were coming out of the theater, you didn't like it, but I guess, or as I remember, you didn't like it. But I mean, it's not... The problem was we came into Can a Song Save Your Life? We saw it on like the second or third screening, and it had screened before, and everyone was like, oh my God, this is the breakout of TIFF. It's going to be amazing. It's going to make so much money. Mark Ruffalo's going to win an Oscar.
Like, Mark Ruffalo's going to win an Oscar for everything.
Yeah, because he's fantastic and everything. I agree. I thought it was all right. I mean, it's fine. The problem with it is that none of the songs are particularly that good or memorable.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be about, you know, they play all these songs. And Keira Knightley's fine. Like, her voice is fine. Adam Levine is surprisingly good, playing basically a version of himself. Kind of like an exaggerated version of himself. Mark Ruffalo is unsurprisingly great. Hailee Steinfeld's in it as his daughter. But I mean, it's all right. It's not a surprise in the end. You kind of see how it's coming together. There are some memorable sequences. There's one where Mark Ruffalo and Keira Knightley walk around the city, listening to an iPod, just listening to music by themselves, not talking. That's kind of neat.
But yeah, I mean, fine. Yeah, I didn't hate it, and I guess maybe given the space, I think it was A, the expectations. B, I really like Once, and it felt like watching Once again, but with the edges rounded off, like without that, it felt distilled. And it's like, okay, but Once doesn't have any stars in it, and it's in a very small town, and it's, you know, and it's not music, you know, it's not big enough to really lure people. And it's like, that's fucking bullshit. Once is great. So I guess that's it. I think it's also my feelings for Once sort of affect Begin Again. For me, Begin Again will always start with a pause. Yeah. Now
it's like, I mean, we've known about that title for forever, but every time I see that title, I do like a double take of like, wait, what's that again? Oh yeah, eh.
Yeah.
Stupid title.
Let's move on to July 11th, where what I believe, which a film I can't wait to see again, and it'll probably be in my top 10, Boyhood. Adam, you want to talk about Boyhood?
Yeah, Boyhood. I mean, there's been, you know, the lore of Richard Linklater has been making a movie for 12 years where he was using the same cast. It was a mom and a dad and a young boy, and he was going to shoot scenes from it once a year, every year. So it's the same cast growing up. And this is a genuine, I mean, masterstroke. Like, this, you will never see anything like this, or you have never seen anything like this. I don't know if anyone's going to attempt to do it again, but
I mean, the closest thing I can think of is like the 7-Up series, but even that isn't really that. That's like, we're going to revisit you 7 years later. This is 12 straight years.
And it's and I feel like it takes someone like Richard Linklater to really do it in a way that the novelty of it doesn't overshadow the story of it, because it's very emotionally resonating, and he hits every single major point of growing up. But and I saw someone, I remember after the Sundance screening, someone described it as, it's an entire movie made up of scenes that would be on the cutting room floor of any drama, because it's the little moments of our life that really shape who we are. And so it's a collection of little moments that follow this kid as he grows up and his life. You know, it's not the, you know, the big shining moments that really define who we are. There's a lot of smaller moments that mold us and shape us into who we
are. And there are a couple big moments in this movie, but it's like, it's the flashes. Like, if you were to look back on your life, you would see the big moments, but you would also think about the little ones as well.
Yeah.
Like, it, but no, absolutely. And I think it also suits Richard Linklater's affinity for just people talking, and by being able to live in those little moments, but not in a way that becomes overbearing. Because just as you think it might be, boom, he's a year older. It's like, what the fuck? You just aged another year.
Yeah.
And like, as the film goes on, it's like, oh shit, 2 hours ago you were just a little kid, and now you're almost an adult. What the fuck just happened?
And instead of ignoring pop culture, because obviously he was filming, you know, scenes for this in like 2004 and whatever, he uses the pop culture of the time in a really interesting way. So, and that's another aspect of it that I really enjoyed, that he doesn't ignore the things that are happening at that time when they're filming. He uses them just to kind of flesh out the story and flesh out.
Yeah, and also to give you a little sense of, like, because the film never flashes up a year.
Yeah.
It never
is
like 8 years old, 9 years old. No, it's like, oh, he's playing like a Game Boy Advance, or there you see Obama Biden signs in a lawn or something, like little things. It's like, oh, okay, we're in about 2007, 2008, something like that. And it's funny to sort of, it's a subtle way of reminding you of what year we're in from a larger perspective, but not in an overbearing way. And sometimes they're just like, do the math yourself. Like,
yeah,
we're not going to it's not, if there's something major happening in the world, like let's say a presidential election, then we're going to note it, but it's still not going to be defined. The big events of the world aren't going to define this person's life.
Yeah.
His life is...
I'm also really interested to see the soundtrack, because the soundtrack was fantastic, but I don't think they had all the rights to everything when we saw it. But that's one of the bigger signposts he uses is music, because, you know, certain songs will bring back certain memories in your life, and it's kind of, he uses those to, throughout the film, to kind of flesh out the time periods and what's going on. So I'm really interested to see how many songs make it from the cut that we saw at Sundance.
And when he does that, this film makes you look back on your life in more ways than way. Both your childhood, and then when you see these little sign parks, like, oh, who I was, not even, you know, when the Game Boy, when the Wii came out, I had already graduated from college, but he's playing it as like, you know, a 10-year-old, but I'm still remembering, like, oh shit, when the Wii came out, I was working at a GameStop selling them. You know, it was the little thing, like, your mind calls back to, I see this signpost or I hear this song, oh, I remember this, what does this say about me? And so it's a coming of age film that even goes beyond just adolescence and being a teenager.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I really can't wait to see it again.
Yeah, and apparently, like, this is, when you say indie, it's like, oh, let's put these on your radar. I was talking to a friend of mine just a few hours ago, and she's like, people are talking about this on Reddit. Like, people on Reddit are really looking forward to this.
Yeah, and I think it's the novelty of it that I think will catapult it, because, you know, something like Entertainment Tonight is going to highlight it, because it's an interesting thing that he, you know, shot for 12 consecutive years using the same cast. So I'm hoping that will make it reach a larger audience, as opposed to so many of these indies that just kind of flash by and general audiences are none the wiser.
Exactly. And that's why we're telling you about most of these, but we can't not talk about Boyhood, because we loved it so much. Also, I think it'll lure some people, because it's like, even though the kid, Eller Coltrane, people don't know who he is, they're like, oh, I know Ethan Hawke, oh, I know Patricia Arquette, who are the only name stars in it. Like, they're the only people that you'd recognize, but they're enough to get you in, or at least provide a comfort zone for the audience. And they're not so big that you'd be like, oh, I'm watching a movie star again, you know? And also, Ethan Hawke just has that relationship with Richard Linklater. It's like, I just, you know, slip into your movies very easily, and you forget that I was in Daywalkers. Was that the name of it? Was it Daywalkers?
So, the family movie. Yes. I had not thought about that movie since it came out. So
it's a good movie.
It up.
It's a good film. So is Boyhood. Better, quite a lot more than Daywalkers. But actually, shit. Now you got me, because I feel like that's what Blade's name is. Nope, it's not Daywalkers. But I can't stop now, because this is gonna bother me for the rest of the podcast. Daybreakers. Thank you, Adam. Moving on to a film that two films you have seen and I have not.
Yes.
I, Origins and Wish I Was Here. Tell us about I, Origins, because you quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, I, Origins was probably my second favorite movie I saw at Sundance, next to Boyhood. It's First of all, do not watch the trailer. Second of all, it's tough. It's a movie that's tough to talk about because the experience of watching it is what makes it so special and emotionally resonant. But essentially, the premise opens. Michael Pitt plays a guy who's doing research into the human eye, because you know, the human eye is very scientifically important to us and can tell us a lot about ourselves. And he's a lab partner played by Britt Marling, and then a girl that he meets with these really interesting and unique eyes, played by Astrid Burgess. I can't remember her.
Frisbee.
Astrid Burgess Frisbee. All three of whom are fantastic. And essentially, the film deals with the push and pull of science versus faith, not only in the world but in us. And it's not a movie that comes down hard on one side. It's about the marriage of kind of a spirituality and also the pragmatic approach of science. And as someone who's studied science in college, that was really interesting to me. And it's also really emotionally effective. It's from director Mike Cahill, who made Another Earth. But this, it's just really fantastic. And I think visually it's a really stunning movie to watch as well. But it's definitely one that is best served by going in cold, because there are quite a few turns. There was a lot of story in this movie, a lot. And at times it just brushes up against the edge of being too much, just telling too much story. But I don't think it does. And yeah, I loved it. Really, really enjoyed it. And then Wish I Was Here is Zach Braff's directorial follow-up to Garden State, which I loved. Garden State. I haven't revisited it in a while, but I'm also a big Zach Braff fan, so I was going into Wish I Was Here with pretty high expectations and was quite disappointed. Zach Braff plays a father of two, kind of living in Los Angeles, and is a struggling actor. And it's kind of about life. It's about him trying to kind of find his role. He has to homeschool his kids, played by Joey Lucas, and then I can't remember his name, but the boy from Looper, who was so fantastic in Looper. While he's doing this, his father is really sick, played by Manny Patinkin, and so he's kind of, I mean, it's a life story. You've seen Garden State, so you kind of know that the plot is secondary to kind of what's going on in the lives of it. And it's not a complete failure. There are moments of the movie that are really, really...
I want to put that on the poster. Not a complete failure.
Well, it's really frustrating, because I was really looking forward to this, and there are moments of the movie that are so good and really touching, and there are moments of the movie that are really, really bad. There's a subplot using Zach Braff's brother in the film, played by Josh Gad, who's a quote-unquote nerd, like with a capital N, and he's just a very kind of stereotypical nerd, and he goes to Comic-Con and he makes these costumes. And I feel like the problem with Wish I Was Here, Zach Braff made this movie with the help of Kickstarter, and he chose to go this route because he wanted to make a movie his way. He wanted to, you know, tell his story without studio notes. And I feel like the problem with this movie is that it didn't have any outside influence telling Braff when to pull back, what to, you know, do slight tweaks to, because with enough tweaks, it could have been a really fantastic movie. And there were those that really liked it. There were those that hated it. I fall somewhere in the middle. So I would say that it's worth seeing, because there is enough good stuff in it. It is very funny, and Zach Braff is really good in it. Manny Patinkin is also really great in it. But there are moments... Oh, and it is also Kate Hudson's best work since Almost Famous. She is the standout of the movie. She is fantastic as Zach Braff's wife. It's a really great performance from her. So I would say it's definitely worth seeing, but temper your expectations a little bit. But yeah, it's also very funny, touching in parts. I don't know. My review... Someone commented on my review. It was like, wow, it really seems like you wanted to like this movie more than you did. It was just frustrating for me, because I was very much looking forward to it.
Okay, you're right. July really is your month, because now we're moving on to A Most Wanted Man, which will... No. It'll be... Well, it'll be Philip... That's Philip Seymour Hoffman's last starring role. I don't know if it'll be seen later this year and maybe some of next year. I don't know how much of Mockingjay he'll be in, but...
He's in... I think he completed work in the first Mockingjay, but he had a few scenes left for the second one.
But he'll be in it, though.
Yes,
like, he had still films and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, he will be.
But he is front and center in A Most Wanted Man, so talk about that one.
Yeah, Most Wanted Man, thriller from director Anton Corbijn, who directed The American... who is adapting a John le Carré novel. And the best way I can describe Most Wanted Man is it is exactly how you think an Anton Corbin adaptation of a John le Carré novel will be. This is not Bourne. This is not a fast-moving thriller. This is a slow burn. And Philip Seymour Hoffman plays a German operative working for kind of an intelligence group in Germany. And the film is essentially a look at the war on terror from an international point of view, which I thought was very fascinating. The response to this movie wasn't over the moon. It was kind of tepid. I liked it a little more than most. It's got thriller aspects to it, but it's more of a drama and kind of a thinker. And Philip Seymour Hoffman is, you know, obviously fantastic in the lead role. Robin Wright is really strong as kind of his American counterpart. And the film kind of gets into how the world is approaching the post 9/11 world, the war on terrorism, post 9/11 world, in direct kind of the opposite to how America is kind of approaching it. And so it's kind of the push and pull of that, but also, you know, this guy who has been working to catch terrorists since 9/11, and he's kind of jaded now, but he's also very driven. Rachel McAdams is also in the film in kind of a supporting role. The title refers to a man that they all suspect is a terrorist that they're trying to find. And so that's kind of the drive of the film. But I enjoyed it. Definitely a slow burn. Philip Seymour Hoffman is very, very good. If you, it's not as slow as The American. So if you're expecting that, it's not that slow. It's not molasses. But it is.
It's not an anti-thriller.
Yeah, it's not an anti-thriller. There are thrilling aspects to it, but it's definitely more of it's a thinking man's thriller, I would say.
Thinking man's thriller. I feel like I have to bring like a pipe and a smoking jacket into that one.
Yeah, if you take your dad who's like looking to see like a Bourne movie or a Bruce Willis movie, he's probably going to be very disappointed. Like my dad was, and when he went to see The American, thinking he was seeing a George Clooney thriller.
Right. Okay, so now it doesn't have a release date yet, but Life Itself, the Roger Ebert, I don't want to say biopic, because I guess it is, but when I say biopic, I always feel like there's a fictional aspect to it, and this is a documentary. But yeah. You saw it at Sundance. What do you think about it?
I did. I really liked it. It's less of a documentary and more of a celebration of not only Roger Ebert's life, but his legacy and kind of what he did for the world of film criticism. Featuring interviews with a lot of not only like fellow film critics, but also filmmakers, Martin Scorsese. And Martin Scorsese has a really, really touching segment talking about how Roger Ebert kind of single-handedly was responsible for kind of pulling him out of his days, you know, when he was on coke and everything and feeling very low. But it's a really entertaining and loving look at Roger Ebert's life. It's not afraid to, you know, everyone kind of describes him as, you know, someone they respected, someone they liked, but someone who was also a real asshole. Like, he could be a dick, and he did not mind being a dick sometimes. And there's a lot of old outtake footage from Siskel and Ebert that's fantastic to watch because they just hated each other. You just see them going at it. And I had the pleasure of watching this movie at Sundance in a screening full of it was a press screening, so it was a screening full of film critics. So that was a really neat experience too. But yeah, it's if you're looking for like, you know, a cradle to grave documentary, like recounting his life and everything that happened in his life, this isn't it. It does get into...
You should probably read his book called Life Itself.
Yeah, it does kind of get into his upbringing and, you know, his early days. And they do have people speaking about that. But it's framed by footage that is directed by Steve James, who directed the brilliant documentary Hoop Dreams. It's framed by Steve James visiting Roger in the hospital. And unfortunately, this documentary was meant to cover, you know, most of Roger Ebert's life, but he died before it was completed. And so, you know, there's, you know, you have all these people loving look on his life, and you cut back to this very, not grim, but kind of unflinching footage of Roger Ebert towards the, you know, the last few months of his life. That's kind of sad to watch. And, but yeah, I mean, it's definitely worth seeing. I liked it quite a bit. Like I said, it's more of a tribute than a, you know, full documentary, but it's really fascinating, especially for cinephiles.
Okay. Yeah, that's definitely one I'm going to be seeking out. Now, I will be coming in with Calvary, which opens on August 1st. And this is from Martin McDonagh, who did The Guard, which is a very funny film starring Brendan Gleeson. Calvary is not a funny film. It does have its moments of comedy, but it's a much... It's just really dark. The premise is that Brendan Gleeson plays a priest in a small village, and during confession, the confessor says that he was abused as a child and that his abuser is now dead, but is sort of a retaliation against God and to people to take notice. He is going to kill the priest, because that will make people pay attention. So Brendan Gleeson doesn't know who it is, but he's basically been told you probably only have 1 week left to give to get your affairs in order. And we just go through the week and watch how this plays out. And Brendan Gleeson, who's just a phenomenal actor, the guy deserves way more love than he gets. I don't think people dislike Brendan Gleeson. It's just they need to know his name, damn it.
Yeah.
They need to know how, because he's in a bunch of stuff. Like, you know, you've seen Brendan Gleeson, all right?
Mad-Eye
you
saw Moody.
Mad-Eye Moody. You saw Harry Potter.
Everyone
you know?
Saw Harry Potter.
Exactly. He's... Harry Potter will now be the reference point for every British actor. You know Maggie Smith. It's, you know, McGonagall. That's who she is. She's the Dowager Countess now, you know. That's, but yeah, that's now your reference point. Who's Jason Isaacs? He's, you know, Malfoy's dad. That's, but getting back to Calvary, it's really good cast. Kelly Riley, Aidan Gillian, who people will know from The Wire and Game of Thrones, he's in it. Chris O'Dowd is in the film. It's really just this very moody, melancholic, but not, I want to go so far to say bleak. It is, because bleak to me is like The Road, where it's just like, let me out. For the love of God, let me out of here. Just bleak does not even begin to describe the road. But Calvary is captivating, and it's really an interesting exploration of notions of faith and responsibility and how people approach these moral obligations that they have. And I just found it just really fascinating on multiple levels when I saw it at Sundance. And so I was, of the three films that I love the most at Sundance were The Raid 2, Boyhood, and Calvary. And not in that order. I liked Boyhood the most, but those are the three A films, if you will, that I saw at Sundance. The other film that comes out on August 1st has also received a shitty title change. It's now called What If, but when Adam and I saw it and loved it at TIFF, it was called The F Word, which is a much better title.
Yes.
The film is about a Daniel Radcliffe, also of the Harry Potter series.
You also may know Daniel Radcliffe.
You may know from Harry Potter. He plays a guy who falls for a girl played by Zoe Kazan, but she is in a relationship, and so he wants to fuck her, but she is a friend, hence the F word. Now, he doesn't want to just have, you know, sex with her, you know, hit it and quit it, if you will. He wants to be in a relationship with her, he wants to be his boyfriend, but he knows that there's really no way to get there. There's just none. Because her boyfriend isn't even that bad of a guy. Rafe Spall plays her boyfriend. And it's just a really smart film to approach subject matter that we have seen before, but it's a mature approach to it. It's also incredibly funny. It's so funny. Adam Driver is in it, the great Adam
there
Driver.
Who, that's how you know it's good.
That's how you know it's good. Much better than Tracks. And it's just, it's from Michael Douse, whose previous film was Goon, which is also a really funny movie. I liked the F word, or What If, more than Goon. I can't wait to see
I did too.
What If again. So I highly encourage, this one was fine. I mean, Adam, do you have anything you want to say about What If?
Yeah, no, it was not only one of the highlights of TIFF, but also one of the like most surprising films. Because, you know, listening to Matt describe the synopsis, you're like, I've seen that before.
I know, right?
Many times, but it's done in such a, like, an interesting way. And also, Zoe Kazan plays the girlfriend, and Zoe Kazan has gained this reputation as of late for being kind of the anti manic pixie dream girl. I don't know if you've seen Ruby Sparks, but she's just.
But you should, because it's amazing.
Yeah, it's great as well. But it's very much, you know, she's an actress who is not going to take a role that's going to paint her as, you know, the typical the girlfriend or the girl that's the object of sex. Like, she's a very.
Like, she's very aware of her look and how films. Like, she was she's a writer,
yeah.
So, as well as an actress. She's very aware of these tropes and
yeah.
how she would, you know, and typecasting. And so she's very smart, you know, she's very smart and as a result has done smart films.
Yeah. And as Matt said, the F word is really funny. I really hope they knock it out of the park with the trailer on that one. CBS Films has it, which really surprised me with their love for Inside Llewyn Davis. So
they try. God bless them.
Yeah,
they try. They poured their heart out on Inside Llewyn Davis.
Yeah.
So much, and I'm so sorry. I feel bad that film didn't go bigger, but at least it's with a studio that cares.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, if this was with the Weinstein Company, you'd be like, oh no.
They just throw shit at a wall to see what sticks. They didn't even know Philomena was their Oscar movie until, like, December. And they were like, oh, we forgot about Philomena. Please, love Philomena. We just, like, released it in a couple theaters, but, you know, who cares? Put it back in
now,
theaters.
Now we've got Philomania.
Yeah, Philomania.
Just, like, because of that joke, because of the DiCaprio mispronouncing it. Oh, that was beautiful. Yeah, so what if... Ugh. Check that out. I'm not, because of the movie. It's just... It's almost it's a runoff between What If and Begin Again for shitty rename titles. And here's something, speaking of retitling things, when we were at Sundance, everyone I talked to was like, oh, they're going to retitle I Origins. I think I'm like, oh, they're going to retitle. No, I Origins is still the title.
Yeah.
It's
and I like
not,
the title. It fits if you've like seen the movie. And
right. It's just, but it's something where it's like, if they had retitled it, you'd be like, yeah, I can understand why.
Yeah. But no, they retitle...
Can't they retitle the well, F word, yeah. Which is, or Can a Song Save Your Life? People that titles that would actually maybe draw people in.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on to so a reminder, those films come out on August 1st. Now moving on to August 15th, Life After Beth. Adam, you saw this one.
Yeah, I did. I saw this one at Sundance as well. It's a zombie rom-com. It's a zombie romantic comedy. It's Aubrey Plaza and Dane DeHaan. Aubrey Plaza, they play a teenage couple. Aubrey Plaza dies and comes back as a zombie, and hilarity ensues. This one didn't really work for me. It was fine. It doesn't really embrace either genre, zombie or comedy. Or romantic comedy, and thus is kind of a mixed bag in the end. It has good supporting work from John C. Reilly and Molly Shannon and Paul Reiser. It is a really good supporting cast. It's a feature directorial debut from Jeff Baena. He hasn't directed before. But yeah, this one was a little disappointing for me. A24 Films has it, so it kind of seems to fit their demographic. I hope, you know, maybe it'll find some fans out there, but there's not really much to say. It wasn't like glaringly awful, but it wasn't, you know, super amazing. I didn't enjoy it that much. It's fine. So just one of those forgettable ones from the festival. So
indeed. Moving on to August 29th, I will take these.
Oh,
two.
And also on Friday.
Oh no,
August 15th
is the one I loved. You
yeah.
didn't see that though.
No,
but
it got,
said good things about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, people said great things about it. It's Mark Duplass and
Elizabeth Moss. Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to skip over that
one. I've heard from everyone that you want to know nothing about it going in.
And I don't.
Yeah.
So
it's apparently it is a twist on the romantic comedy or relationship comedy genre.
Yeah.
So
I almost... Yeah, I forgot. I had scrolled too far. August 22nd is Love is Strange, a film that everyone else at Sundance loved and I thought was fucking abysmal. It was easily the worst film I saw there. It's one of those things, like, I feel like I'm on crazy pills. Like, how is everyone loving this film except me? I couldn't... I tweeted out how much I hated it, and the director tweeted me back. He's like, oh, at least my film got a response from you. I'm like, it did! That's true.
Yeah, you didn't tweet like, oh, I didn't care for it. You were like, that was fucking abysmal. And he was like, eh, that bad, eh? I was like, whoa, that guy's got balls.
Well, you know, I mean, look, I'm glad he was willing to engage, and it wasn't like, you know, he wasn't like dismissing my opinion.
It's Iris Axe, for those who don't know.
Iris Axe, yeah. It wasn't like when I tweeted about when I was at South by Southwest a couple of years ago and I went to the Stephen Hawking documentary and I'm like, this is, you know, and I wrote a negative review and one of the directors or the producers like, well, clearly you didn't understand the point of the film. And I tweeted back at him, was it about the power of the human spirit? Because you said that at the end of the film. So there wasn't that. Hawking sucks, by the way. But this is Love is Strange, which is far, far worse. The plot of Love is Strange is that Alfred Molina and John Lithgow play a gay couple. And they are the only redeeming aspect of this film. Their performances are so good, and they're so good together. So naturally, the film feels the need to split them up. Because what happens is that they get married after being in a relationship for a long time. Molina works as a choir director at a Catholic school. They fire him for now being openly gay, even though he was, but now he's married, so whatever. And so now they can't afford their nice place in Manhattan. So here are their options. They have to find a new place, and they could stay together in Poughkeepsie, but it's a long drive and they don't know how to drive. So instead, what they'll do is they will crash separately at different places. Alfred Molina will stay in the building with their gay neighbors, and John Lithgow will go stay with family. And they wear out their welcomes where they both are, and they both are unhappy where they are being separated. Everyone in this film is intolerable and petty. And that includes Lithgow and Molina, because as good as their performances are, you have to say, the film is basically saying, oh, they love each other so much. It's like, no, they fucking don't. Because if they did, they'd be in fucking Poughkeepsie and learning how to drive. It's like, our love can withstand anything except, you know, staying, you know, we don't want to live in Poughkeepsie. Our love can't stand Poughkeepsie, New York, God forbid. And the film actually takes time to be like, oh, tell me more about how property taxes work in New York. I'm really fascinated about this. This is a film made by people who, like, if you live in New York, like, oh, I can really relate. And like, well, I don't live in New York. And this makes people who live in New York look really bad. So as you can tell, I'm very passionate about not liking Love is Strange. So I'm just going to skip to August 29th, where I will passionately recommend The Congress, which is the new film from, oh my God, now I was so busy hating Love is Strange, I forgot the director of Ari, oh my God, Adam, help me. For the love of God, help me. Who directed Waltz with Bashir?
Oh, I'm with you. I can't remember the name.
Oh, shit. It's the director of Waltz with Bashir. It's his new...
Ari Fulman.
Okay, I was halfway there. Ari Fulman. This is his follow-up. It stars Robin Wright as a version of herself. She plays an actress who's on the decline, so you have to imagine this is a world where House of Cards never happened, and she didn't. What if Robin Wright didn't experience a career resurgence, and also had a kid who was slowly going blind and deaf, and they lived in an airplane hangar? And she is offered a contract with Marimount Pictures. Her agent's played by Harvey Keitel. The studio is played by Danny Houston. And she is offered a contract. And the contract says, we will scan you into a computer and be able to use your likeness for anything. And you will be immortal, and we will pay you handsomely, basically giving her the money to treat her son that she needs. But she can never act again. And that's the trade-off. And so she does decide to make this trade, and then when shit gets really interesting, because then the film really goes in this interesting place of, it starts off with like this almost satirical take on Hollywood, where, well, shit, if we're making such advances in animation, and animation becomes more important than actors, and we have the technology to make our CGI creations look more and more realistic, but we still need stars and recognizable actors. What happens if we just scan them into computers? Does it matter to an audience at all? And so if people can't tell the difference anymore, and what does that say about the craft of acting and the cravenness of Hollywood and our taste as an audience, where, you know, we're going to go see all these big blockbusters this year, and most and half of them are largely animated, even if they're live action. If you watch a documentary called Life After Pi, which is about Rhythm and Hues, the effects studio behind Life of Pi, and they basically folded a few days before their film ended up winning Best Visual Effects. And Life of Pi, I do not think would have gotten... it's a film that couldn't have been made without visual effects. And so you take away all that stuff, and you see how important visual effects are to movies. And it's like, well, what now if actors are visual effects? And I won't spoil where the Congress goes, but it goes to a really crazy place where humanity itself has basically sucked itself into a computer. And, like, we're kind of there right now. So this notion that you can craft who you want to be and any power, and it goes, it's really creative. It can be a little slow at parts, but it's a fascinating film with really trying to look at certain implications. So the Congress, it really blew me away when I saw it at the Atlanta Film Festival. The other film is Life of Crime, and that one is, it's sort of like Life After Beth. It's like, it's fine. the premise of it, it's based off James Elroy, or Elmore, I'm sorry, Elmore Leonard, my apologies, novel, and stars John Hawks and Yassine Bey as Ordell, Robbie, and... oh my gosh, Louis Guerra, whose character names you might seem familiar if you've seen Jackie Brown. These are the same characters, but younger. And they've both just gotten out of prison, and so they've come up with a kidnapping scheme to kidnap the wife of Mickey Dawson, who's the wife of a wealthy guy. And so they're holding her hostage. The husband is Frank Dawson, played by Tim Robbins. And it's a crime comedy film, but with some unexpected moments of darkness, especially from Yassine Bey's character. Honestly, you know, I'm talking about this film.
Yassine Bey is Mos Def.
Is Mos Def.
Just call him Mos Def.
But he wants to be called Yassine Bey.
Sure, but I don't know who Yassine Bey is.
All right, it's Mos Def. It's one of those things where I want to respect what the actor wants to
be
called.
I was joking.
It's why I call The Rock Dwayne Johnson. That being said, although he's used Dwayne Johnson far more than Mos Def has used Yassine Bey. So, yes, you know, most people know him as Mos Def. Either way, he's a good actor. He's good in this film. Everyone is good in this film. It's entertaining, but I'm struggling to remember it because I saw it at TIFF and it's just not that memorable. It's a film where, quite honestly, when I saw it, I'm like, oh, this is going to go straight to VOD. And it's not, well, I don't know. Does Roadside Attractions do straight to VOD? I forget.
They do some VOD, yeah.
They do some VOD. It sounds like a VOD film, but its theatrical release will be on August 29th. So that brings us to the end of summer. And before you know it, it'll be TIFF again. Huzzah!
No, I'm looking forward to it.
We are looking forward to it. There. Inherent Vice, probably.
Yeah. I mean, last year we saw, like, the big Best Picture almost all of the Best Picture nominees were there, so...
That's true.
Get a jump on all of them.
Yeah. I hope Foxcatcher will be there.
I do, too, selfishly. I mean, I know it's playing at Cannes, and I mean, last year both Nebraska and Inside Llewyn Davis were at Cannes and didn't come to TIFF, so I don't have high hopes, but that is...
Well, maybe. I mean, I think maybe TIFF is going to fight harder... I think last year they played on presumptions. Like, already they're cracking down and saying if your film can't premiere at Telluride anymore.
Yeah.
We're tired of having Telluride be preview night. We want the films to premiere at TIFF. And so I'm hoping that they're taking a more proactive stance, because it's not like Nebraska and Inside Llewyn Davis skipped the festival circus. They went to New York, which is a smaller film festival, and God help me, I went there. I really don't want to have to go to the New York Film Festival again. I mean, New York is fine, but I had to sleep on an air mattress for 2.5 weeks. And it was worth it because I got to see Inside Llewyn Davis and Nebraska and Her, and they all ended up on my top 10 list. But usually New York Film Festival is like 3 big movies and maybe one. Like the year before, it was Lincoln. Like, okay, Lincoln is here. And I honestly don't remember what else played at New York Film Festival that year. But in any event, selfishly, you know, we will get to see Foxcatcher in November, right? It's been set for November?
Yep.
Yeah. So we will get to see it.
Prime award season release date.
Exactly.
That is one of my most anticipated movies of the year.
Likewise. And I'm very curious to hear the word out of Cannes on it.
Yeah, definitely.
So we'll see. But in any event, this is the summer. I hope you... Explosions! And obviously, there are indie films coming out this summer that we did not see. And we want to see, like... The one I love. I was about to say, like Love is Strange. I'm like, no, not Love is Strange! It's like, but it has love in the title. No, it's The One I Love is one we want to see. But there's a bunch of films. There are a lot of indies. Some you shouldn't see. But there are a good amount that you should. So in between your blockbuster excursions, try to see the films that we've talked about in this podcast. We will finish up with our recommendations by talking about indie films of yesteryear that you can see right now. Adam, what do you got for us?
Yeah, just kind of in keeping with the theme. I mean, I know we've previewed all of these indie films, but it seems like a lot of them come and go very quickly or are in theaters for like a week. And that's what happened with my recommendation from last year. It is Don John, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's directorial debut. He wrote and directed it. We saw it at Sundance last year. Everyone was talking about how commercial it was going to be, how big of a hit it was going to be. I thought it was going to be a big crossover hit, but it made $6 million on its entire box office run, which was quite...
Jeez, I thought it was more successful than that.
Yeah, it was not. Nobody saw it.
Wow.
And it was just disappointing because it's actually a pretty good film. Joseph Gordon-Levitt also stars in the movie. It's kind of a modern-day take on the Don Juan story. He's essentially playing and people laugh when I say this, but he's playing a fictional version of the situation from Jersey Shore. Is basically his character. As when the movie starts off, he's obsessed with working out and tanning, and he's addicted to porn first and foremost. And
it used to be called Don John's Addiction. That was the
It was called Don John's Addiction when we saw it at Sundance, and he meets a nice girl that he likes named Barbara Sugarman, played by Scarlett Johansson.
I don't know if she's nice. She's hot.
Yeah. And she's just kind of this Jersey girl who's, obsessed with romantic comedies. And essentially what Gordon-Levitt was getting at, which was really tough to get across in the previews, it's not a movie about porn addiction. It's about how unrealistic expectations of both sexes cause problems in relationships. Men watching, or in Don John's character, watching porn, can't ever recreate that feeling in sex. He much prefers pornography to sex. But Scarlett Johansson's character, Barbara Sugarman, is I would say just as guilty, in that she loves going to see these romantic comedies and she feels like that should be reality, and as the same way that Don John feels like the porn should be reality, what he gets out of that is what should happen when he's having sex with a girl. And Scarlett Johansson feels like these stories that they go and see on the screen are how relationships should be in real life, and they're both unrealistic expectations and they cause problems for both because they're not living in reality. And Gordon-Levitt has a really interesting visual eye in this movie. I was very pleasantly surprised by. And there are some really great fake movies that they go to see, fake romantic comedies featuring cameos that I will not spoil, which I think were in the trailers, but they're fun to watch. Brie Larson is excellent in this. She has one total line, I think, but that's by design. Tony Danza is probably the standout in the supporting role. He plays Joseph Gordon-Levitt's dad, and Julianne Moore also plays a pretty big part in the film as well. But it is now on Netflix Instant Watch. So if you missed it last year, I would recommend seeing it. It shows a very promising career on Gordon-Levitt's directorial side, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing what he does next. I hope he directs again in the future.
Okay. I found it enjoyable. It was a funny film.
Yeah, it's nothing mind-blowing, but it's one that I feel like people missed, and I think it could be a touchstone in the future for saying, like, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, how did he get to be such a good director? Like, I feel like this is a movie that shows a lot of promise from him.
A lot of promise, as a director. Yeah. My recommendation will be The Station Agent, which played at Sundance in 2003. is directed by Tom McCarthy, who went on to direct The Visitor and Win Win, and all three of his films are just fantastic. The Station Agent, which was his debut, stars Peter Dinklage, and this was his breakout role. It also stars Bobby Cannavale. This is his breakout role. And when I say breakout, I mean I'm not like, now they're huge star. Well, Dinklage is. But these are the ones that I feel like, this film I feel really got the ball rolling and put them on people's radars. Dinklage is the star. He plays a guy that kind of just wants to be left alone in this small town because he's a dwarf and he just doesn't want to have to deal with that from other people. So he's kind of aloof. And he works in a small train depot that's just kind of abandoned. But he wants to be left alone. And then he just starts coming up with these unlikely friendships. One with Cannavale's character. And then a relationship with another character played by Patricia Clarkson. And it's just, it's a very character-driven film. But it's very sweet and funny. And which is sort of what you see, but also with dramatic heft, like serious, you know, these characters have to deal with things that are real. And you see that in all of McCarthy's films. Like, they're very big on great performances. They're still funny. There's a lot of heart to them. And the reason I recommend The Station Agent is because not only is it his first film, but you can also catch it on Netflix. So I strongly, strongly recommend checking out The Station Agent, especially if you're like, I'm a huge Game of Thrones fan, and like, well, have I got good news for you. If you want to see Peter Dinklage outside of that in a great performance, watch The Station Agent. So thanks for listening, everyone.
And if also, thinking Tom McCarthy, indie guy, I don't know who he is, he co-wrote Up, so he's a pretty talented guy.
He's pretty good. He's a pretty good writer. He's also an actor. He was in the 5th season of The Wire as a sleazy reporter. You may recognize him from that. He also I forgot that he wrote the upcoming Million Dollar Arm. So I gotta remember to go see that. In any case, Station Agent. So thank you for listening, everyone. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you should follow us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
At Adam Chipwood.
Next week, we'll be talking about Spider-Man.
Spider-Man!
Oh, boy. That's going to be a start. Just looking at the advance word. I'm seeing it tomorrow night. Adam, you're seeing it, what, Tuesday morning?
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah.
Hopefully, yeah. All right.
We'll always Garfield and Stone. I feel like,
yeah, exactly. We'll only
into it seeing something that's going to be terrible. And I like Marvel, right. So here's being pleasantly surprised.
Sure. Hopefully I'll be pleasantly surprised. I like the new costume. I like the cast. They're good actors. I don't think anyone's like, fuck Dane DeHaan. Well, some people might be, I don't know. They shouldn't be. He's a good actor. But it's got good cast. We'll see how it turns out. But I will say, based at least on The Amazing Spider-Man 1, I just want to see Emma Stone and Andrew Garfield in like more of like a madcap, like 1940s, like screwball comedy. That's what I'd like to see.
Directed by Billy Wilder.
By the ghost of Billy Wilder. Yes. All right, cool. Well, thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back with you next week.